Okay. So we'd like to welcome all of you to the...
Archiving started.
Okay, I got to start again. Welcome to the Polar Connect event. We're very excited to be talking with Polar Trek teacher Michael League and his researcher Adam Marsh. They're all down at McMurdo Station in Antarctica. And today is September 29th, 2011. This is... Janet Warburton, and I have Sarah Crowley. We're here at ARCUS, the Arctic Research Consortium of the United States, and we're based in Fairbanks, Alaska. So today, I guess we're connected with New Jersey, Antarctica, and Fairbanks. So it's kind of spread out around the world. That's pretty neat what kind of technology can do this do for us. So just to give you some idea of why Mike is in Antarctica with Adam Marsh, we have a slide up about the program. It's called Polar Trek, and it's a program for teachers like your teacher, Mrs. Babb, as well as teachers like Mr. League, and they get to go out with researchers and do science with the researchers in the Arctic or the Antarctic. And we are a program that's funded by an agency in Washington, D.C. called the National Science Foundation. And we're very excited to offer this opportunity for teachers so they can become better science teachers and that you get to learn what kind of science is happening in the polar regions. And a few things for your teacher. So, Mrs. Babb, when you want to ask questions, we'll have a lot of time because this is a very personal event for you guys. You can type in questions or you can just click on the little hand icon and we'll just go to you, your classroom, and you can ask your question live. And when you do, press that talk button and hold it down the entire time you're talking and then let go. And with that, we're just going to turn this right over to Mike and Adam, and we'll let them talk. So go ahead.
Well, good morning, Mrs. Babb and fifth graders in New Jersey. This is Mike calling you live from Antarctica to say good afternoon on your Thursday. And though it might be your Thursday, we're in a different part of the world. And so it's actually very early on Friday morning for us. I think it's 1 p.m. on Thursday for you and 6 a.m. on Friday for us. So if we could go to the next slide, one of the reasons that Mrs. Babb said it would be nice for us to call is because what we're doing down here relates to a lot of things that you'll be studying throughout this year. And I have partnered up with a fabulous research team. There are five of us, and I am the guy on the right-hand picture. My name is Mike, and also joining us on the call this morning is Dr. Adam Marsh. He's in the upper left-hand corner. Additionally, we have three other fabulous team members, Dr. Stacy Kim, Stephanie Guida, and Anna Marie Pasqualoni, and together we are working very hard to study the adaptations of marine worms. You could go to the next slide. One of the things that Mrs. Babb said that you would be studying this year is the word biome. And what you should be looking at is a map of all the different biomes of the world. And a biome is an area of our planet that has very similar conditions, similar temperature, similar amounts of precipitation. And as a result, you tend to see a lot of animals with similar adaptations that live in similar biomes. If you take a look at the very, very bottom of this map, you'll see just a little outline of part of the continent of Antarctica, and that's where we are. And Antarctica is an interesting biome because most of it is covered entirely by ice, and so it's very different from where you live in New Jersey. You go to the next slide. Antarctica is a really big place, and so it becomes very easy to get confused as to where exactly we are. But McMurdo Station is located on a very small island called Ross Island in the middle of a frozen ocean. That's right, it's so cold here that the ocean actually freezes solid. And so McMurdo Station is located on the very, very tip of a peninsula. And we are surrounded by that frozen ocean, and it's that frozen ocean where the worms live that we are interested in studying. If you were to zoom in on this map, you'll see the photo that you would see on the next slide, which is a photo of McMurdo Station. A lot of people think that this is such a rough wilderness that we must live in tents, but in actuality, there's a rather large little city here. And we're just about to start receiving our first airplane flights of people for the Antarctic summer. And so very soon we'll be receiving almost 1,000 more people here on station who will be busy conducting science during the summer. This little city is located in a very different situation than where you live. And if we go to the next slide, you'll see a little bit about what I'm talking about. We left in August from Delaware, which is not too far from where you are. And in Delaware in August, it's quite nice. It's usually temperatures in the 80s. And if you take a look at that green line, that's the average temperature by month. And so in August, it's one of the higher points. We came down to Antarctica, and that's the blue line with the picture by the penguins. And August happens to be one of Antarctica's coldest months. Our seasons are opposite. So we left Delaware and New Jersey summer, and we headed down to Antarctica just in time to catch the tail end of their winter. On the next slide, one of the neat things that we saw when we got here was all the mountains that surround town and all the beautiful light. So this is sort of a sunrise, sunset type of lighting, and those are the Royal Society Mountains. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see more about some of the beautiful scenes that we have been able to take in. This is a shot of Castle Rock, which is a pretty famous rock structure. And then that big mountain in the left in the background is called Mount Erebus. It's actually the southernmost active volcano in the world. So here we are at 77 degrees south latitude, very close to the bottom of our planet. And we are doing some science and research and scuba diving close to the southernmost active volcano, experiencing some very, very challenging weather conditions. If you go to the next slide, we have been rewarded with some beautiful scenery. These are called nacreous clouds, and you only get them way down here close to the South Pole and way up close to the North Pole. But they have beautiful colors and very different from some of the clouds that we see. One last slide for you appears on the next one, and that's some data about the temperature since we got here. Lynette, would you be willing to have someone tell us a little bit about the weather in Sparta? Is it warm there?
Well, here in New Jersey, it's warm, I guess, and we're going into fall, so it's still pretty warm and it's very rainy.
So probably very warm for you, I'm guessing, is in the 70s maybe. And if you take a look at this graph, everything below the red line is a day that we were below zero. And the coldest day we experienced was 40 degrees below zero with a wind chill of 80 degrees below zero. And currently right now, it's 9 degrees below zero with a wind chill of 22. So if we go outside right now, it feels like 22 degrees below zero. And so we're about 100 degrees colder than you guys are in New Jersey. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see a little bit about what I'm discussing here and why I'm talking about it. And that is that human beings don't handle the extreme cold very well. In this picture, you can see that I'm not wearing my extreme cold weather gear, all my layers and hats and gloves and coats. And so my body loses heat energy to the air very quickly. But Anna Marie has on her nice coat and hat, and she's transferring heat energy much slower. And on the left there, you can see that day that I was talking about when we took this was a temperature of minus 40 and a wind chill of minus 81. So one of the first things people are always interested in is what do you wear? So if you go to the next slide, you'll see the extreme cold weather gear that we are all issued. And if you look across the slide, you'll see that we've gotten a lot of gear. And so just to go outside to do some work, it takes us 10 minutes to put on all of our clothing to get ready. It's not an easy task to work outside here in Antarctica. And so we've been here for about a month, and after getting used to all of these different situations with different amounts of light, a different season, being in a different biome, we have begun some very important scientific work. So this slide is going to give you a little bit of a look at what we've done, and then we're going to go into a lot more detail about each of these. So the goofy guy in the picture there is me, and I'm scuba diving under the ice there. That's been one of the major activities. And, of course, to get to the water, you have to first drill a hole. So we've spent a lot of time drilling holes and scuba diving under the ice. When we get under there, we're interested in a worm that lives in the sediment or mud. And so we've been scooping some buckets and collecting some sediment. And then we've also been taking a lot of photos and video underwater that we're going to share with you this afternoon. To give you a little sense of what it takes to get ready to go diving in Antarctica, I'd like to let Dr. Adam Marsh tell you a little bit about drilling a hole in the sea ice. So here he is.
The previous slide we were looking at shows a large, what we call a reed drill, and it's a big tractor diesel engine that drives a four-foot auger bit, and that four-foot-wide bit then drills a perfect hole, grinds a perfect hole in the ice for that we can dive through, that people can fit through with dive gear on. And the sea ice now is at about 6 to 7 feet thick to get from the surface of the ice down to where the water is. Now, on the next slide, you'll see that we've got a hut pulled off to the side. That big orange thing is a fish hut. It's a portable structure that we pull out onto the ice. There's a nice round hole that we're fishing ice chips. Mike and I are fishing ice out of. That hole we've just drilled. We're cleaning it out. And then the bulldozer is going to pull the fish hut over that hole. And there's a hole in the floor of the fish hut. The fish hut's got a little heater in it. And what it does is it helps keep the hole from freezing over after we've drilled it. Next slide is just another picture of the hut. They've got nice doors. They're dressed up with little windows. They kind of look like little houses. And believe me, in a frozen wilderness like this, when you see one of these orange huts out on the sea ice, you know that, at least it's warm inside, right? So that we really like driving up to a hut when it's cold and you're frosty outside. Getting inside and setting up for dive gear is much easier than trying to do it outside. In the next slide, the general overlay presentation of all the dive gear that we would wear during a normal dive. So we would pack our dive bags with things like, you can see the blue scuba fins. There are two yellow lights, right? Because of the thickness of the sea ice and the snow on top, there's very little light that gets under the sea ice into the bottom. And so we always treat the dives as night dives, and we always have lights available. We've got some hoods, masks, a couple of layers of gloves, some collection bags, and then the thing in the top left, the little black, white, and red thing up the top, that's the dry suit. That's actually what we wear, put our bodies into, right, to keep us dry. On the right-hand side, right, is a standard tank rig, and you can see the hose with the two regulators coming out, and those regulators are what we put in our mouth. Those are the little mouth pieces you can see on them. Now, in the next slide, are some of the vehicles that we would use to get around from town to different dive sites. Now, because it's snowy out here, we have to have vehicles with different kinds of wheels on them. Thick snow, we have to cross cracks on sea ice. So in the top left, we have what's called a Matrax. And it looks like a pickup truck, but it's just been fitted with special, well, they're not wheels, but they're little tread units. So it's like a little bulldozer treads that the truck drives around on so we can get out on the sea ice. We look at the down the lower left, see what's called a piston bowling. This is a machine that's designed for really just snow grooming, that is traveling through heavy, thick snow fields. So it's got a really wide, long track on it. And actually, we spend most of our time in this vehicle because it's very good for driving out around on the sea ice. The top right, we also do some work off of snowmobiles, although riding snowmobiles down here is really, really frosty. Very chilly to start a dive when you're having done a snowmobile ride. And then there are some places that we just can't drive to, and that for that we need helicopters. And the helicopter support down here allow us to fly out and get about anywhere from about 120 to 150 miles away from station. On the next slide, we have a special, well, I might talk about the next slide and who's driving.
Okay, so in this slide, you see us preparing for a typical day of diving, and this is our piston bully with Stephanie in the passenger seat. We've been fortunate, if you've looked at our journals, to have a traveling companion with us. That's Theodore. Theodore's from a class in Florida, and he's been doing some interesting work down here in Antarctica with us. In fact, Mrs. Babb, if your students have suggestions for experiments that they'd like to see us do, you can submit ideas and questions to the Ask Theodore part of our forum. We can tell you how to do that a little later on in the talk. So a typical dive would begin here in the piston bully. We'd load up all our gear and take off across the sea ice. And if you take a look at the next slide, you'll see some of the sights that we see on our way to the dive. Remember, we're traveling across a frozen ocean. And as Dr. Marsh said, even though it looks flat and solid, it's actually about 6 to 7 feet of ice. And underneath that can be thousands of feet of ocean. And we drive these big machines out there. So in addition to beautiful scenery like this, or on the next slide, you'll see Mount Erebus in some beautiful lighting. We also have to be watching the surface of the ice. And we're watching for places where energy is being transferred through the sea ice and could cause some potential problems, like what you see on the next slide. This is a crack in the sea ice. And we've been told that this crack has been opened quite a bit since I took this picture. In fact, now it's almost 3 feet or 4 feet wide between the two edges. And so you can see that the sea ice really does change a lot. And all that energy gets transferred to the ice. Some of the cracks are quite beautiful. If you go to the second slide, you'll see that the cracks really show the different stresses on the ice. You can see these sort of lines where the water and ice have been pulled apart. And then all those little bumps are the beginning of ice formation called frost flowers. And they are quite beautiful. So when we get to a dive site, the first item of business is to unload our gear and to get ready to go diving. So remember that hole that we, Dr. Marsh talked about drilling in the ice? Well, that's what we pull up to, is that heated dive hut and the hole right in the middle. And we need to put on all that gear that he was talking about. So those big red things are our dry suits, and underneath them we have lots of layers of insulation to keep us warm. We put on our big heavy weight belts and our tanks. All told, we probably wear about 75 pounds worth of gear, somewhere between 60 and 75 pounds. So we're not always the most graceful above the water. But after we're all suited up, we sort of plunge kind of a graceful fall into the dive hole, which you'll see on the next slide. This is a photo looking down the dive hole. And you can see a couple of important features. One, you can see the ice, and you can see how thick it is. Two, you can see a line that goes straight down from the dive hut with black and white checkered flags and strobe lights on it. And that helps us to locate the hole when we are underwater. And then finally, you'll also see a ladder, and we use the ladder to get back out of the dive hole at the end of the dive. And so all of those parts and pieces are kind of necessary for us to have a successful dive. So why do we do all this? Why do we drive for an hour across a frozen ocean? Why have we come all this way to Antarctica and dive underneath 6 feet of ice in 28-degree water? Well, it's because of what you see underneath. Above the ice, it's sort of a barren wasteland. Antarctica is sort of a polar desert. There aren't a lot of animals that live above the ice. It's very cold. There's a lot of snow and ice. And underneath, there are a tremendous amount of animals. And so Dr. Marsh is going to tell you a little bit about what we're doing underneath the ice to collect the worms. And then later on, we'll get into some of the stuff that we see.
On the next slide, we will see Mike is under the water, and he's wearing what we call a surface supply rig. Now, the previous underwater work, you've seen slides of us with scuba gear on. Scuba gear is where you wear the air tanks on your back. One of the areas where we're collecting on is right off station, because we're looking for an organism that's very sensitive to the presence of pollution. And so we are diving in a sort of a contaminated environment. And to do that kind of diving, we have to wear these helmet rigs so that our faces are separated or kept clean from the environment itself. It's a bit awkward at first to have this be your head inside a helmet and trying to swim underwater with this, this yellow cord that has oxygen that carries your air down. But once you get used to it, it's actually pretty nice in the sense that it keeps your head much warmer in terms of you don't have the cold water constantly pressing against your face. On the next slide, we'll see a picture of one of the outfall pipes in the area. And so this is the sewage outfall pipe where the treated wastewater is released into the ocean off the station. You can see there are a couple of organisms and hydroids growing on the pipe itself. But in a photo on the bottom left is a little worm called Capitella. And this Capitella worm is the worm that we're here to study. It's, as I said, it's sensitive to pollution. Its presence is often associated with human impacts in environments. And we're here to understand how that worm lives both with the human impact of the station around here and plus cold polar temperatures that exist. In the next slide, we show the processing for obtaining the worm. And when we're down on the bottom, we've got, in the top right corner, we have these white buckets underwater. We fill them with mud off the bottom. Then when we get into the lab, we run that mud through these different size sieves. And a sieve is just essentially a round metal ring with a screen in the bottom of different sizes, right? And we use the sieves to collect particles of certain sizes to trap animals on them. And in the right panel, you'll see Stephanie. She's been sieving some worms on the sieve and is now using a pair of tweezers to pick them off the sieve. But often when you're sieving, they crawl out of the mud and they crawl into the metal screen, it's there, and then we pick them off of the screen on that side. The next slide shows Anna Marie. She's been picking worms. She's got a little one in her tweezers, and on the right side, you'll see a dish in which she's picked out a lot of these little Capitella worms, and because they are cold adapted, we keep them all on ice. We try to do all those sitting live, and actually, the room that the girls are working in is actually pretty chilly as well. In the next slide, we summarize some of the adaptations of things that we are looking at. That is, organisms are adapted. That is, they are optimized. They have an there is an environment that they are optimal to function in. And this optimization includes things like body structure, which would be morphology and also biochemistry. It includes adaptations in behavior, that is how animals react, what kinds of activities they have in a particular environment. And it can be special skills or processes, that is, there may be something very unique about that environment that that animals have to do in order to obtain food. These adaptations, right, allow organisms to survive in the environment, and by surviving, they can reproduce and build a population. So by by being successful, then, organisms then populate these areas. So what we're really looking at here in Antarctica is a lot of why some of the organisms are very successful here and can live here, but not in other places. That is, why, what is it about being in a low-temperature environment here that makes them adapted for survival? Now, in the next slide, we're going to go through a couple of pictures of organisms down here. The first animal slide, this is a big sea urchin. Big starfish. This starfish is probably about twice your hand, two hand sizes, or twice two of my hand sizes across. It's very large, and one of its adaptations is that because it's very large, it can hold lots of eggs. That is, it can make lots of babies. And so one of the strategies about being large here is that you can produce lots and lots of young, right, to help keep your population density high. In the next slide, we have a very large sponge. And again, these large sponges, this is probably about 3.5 feet tall. These large sponges are big filter feeding organisms. They pull water in from the outside, and then they pump it through this sponge wall, and then the water exits out the center through the top hole in the sponge. These sponges can be fairly old, they're very large, and by being as big as they are, it's harder for organisms to eat them. Right? Or some starfish will eat sponges. So by being large, you can avoid predation. There's also a general phenomenon down here in Antarctica where most marine organisms are large, and we call it gigantism. Gigantism, that means they are much bigger than the species in other normal environments. In the next slide, we have, again, two more filter-feeding organisms. The one with the white feathery things, tentacles coming off a tube, this is actually a worm inside that tube. And the adaptation that this worm has is it has a special feeding apparatus, these white pinnules, these white tentacles. And these tentacles serve to allow the worm to pull food particles out of the water column. So most of the worms you're familiar with don't have any kind of special tentacles on them, but in this polar environment, this worm does, because it feeds out of the water column. And the small thing on the right side of it is a sea anemone. The next slide, we have what's called a sea spider. Now, this sea spider, again, is probably as big as my hand. Now, what's interesting is that in Delaware, New Jersey, we also have sea spiders out in the ocean, the coast, but they're only as big as sort of the fingernail on your little pinky. They're really tiny. But again, here in Antarctica, we have gigantic organisms, much larger body sizes. And again, it partially is an escape from predation. It's by the bigger it is, the harder it is for something to eat it. And also, by being bigger, this picnic goer is able to eat other things that it normally wouldn't be able to eat or capture if it was smaller. Right? So it's a feeding adaptation. In the next slide, we have these large jellyfish. Jellyfish are in the water very, very frequently around. They've got long, long tentacle feeding nets. And these tentacle nets, right, are what allow them to capture food particles out of the water. There's not much in the water. It's very clear. There are very few particles. And so they have to have very long, elaborate tentacle structures in order to catch enough food to survive. In this next slide, we see a fish. Now, this fish is a very common species down here, and it is actually resting inside a sponge. Right? There's a white, big white sponge, but inside in the middle is a fish sitting there. So this kind of hiding behavior is also an adaptation. The fish down here aren't able to swim very well. They can't swim up in the water column because they don't have swim bladders. And so they spend a lot of time of their time just sitting on the very bottom. And so when they do sit, if they were out in the open, they would be easy prey for predators. And so by hiding inside a sponge, the fish can avoid predation. In the next slide, we have more filter feeding organisms and a large, large worm. Let's talk about the large pink worm that you see in the middle. This is what we call a Nemertian worm. It's very unrelated to what you know as an earthworm. Right? It's a very different kind of an organism. But this worm can grow to be 5 to 6 feet long on the bottom down here. It's very common, it's very big, and it produces a lot of gross slime whenever you pick it up. Right? So we generally try to avoid touching and collecting these guys because they are disgusting to handle. In the next slide, we see a field of starfish and sea urchins. And more importantly, we see ice. Now, the seawater around McMurdo is 28 degrees Fahrenheit. It's right at the freezing point of water. And so the fuzzy stuff that you see sort of in the middle of your field isn't because the photograph is out of focus. It's because there's ice crystals forming off the bottom. And again, the water is right at the point of that phase transition between being a liquid and a solid. And so often in these areas, ice crystals are constantly growing off the bottom, and then they may melt a little ways, grow a little more, melt a little ways. And so you get this constant dynamic play between liquid and solid water right there in the environment. Now, liquid seawater is good for the animals you see here, like the starfish and the sea urchins, but ice is not. Right? And so ice itself is also a selective force. Okay. And now Mike is going to jump in.
On our ways to the dive sites, we've also been seeing some of these organisms, which are called Weddell seals. Weddell seals have a lot of adaptations to the environment. They have a lot of thick blubber, which helps to insulate them and keep them warm. And although they look pretty goofy on top of the ice, underneath the water, where we've seen them on many of our dives this year, they are streamlined and torpedo-shaped, and they move very gracefully in the water. They make divers look incredibly uncoordinated as they swim by with just a little flick of a flipper. The next slide will show you seal pup. We are coming up on seal pup season, and as Dr. Marsh said, one of the major goals of organisms and their adaptation is to be able to reproduce. And so here a seal pup is probably just less than a month old out on the sea ice, ready to start learning to swim and become a productive member of the ecosystem. And there's one other sort of major organism that students usually associate with Antarctica, and that appears on the next slide, and that is the penguin. There are two types of penguins here in Antarctica. We see emperor penguins, like the one on the left. These penguins are as tall as some of you fifth graders and also have some unique adaptations. Their feathers trap a lot of air to help insulate them. Again, they have a very torpedo shape for making them able to swim through the water very quickly. They feed on a lot of the fish that Dr. Marsh was pointing out to you. And also the Adelie penguin, which is on the right. It's much smaller, a bit more comical. We see it walking along the ice, and it falls down quite frequently and kind of slides on its tummy, an act we call tobogganing. Again, it has feathers, which trap the air and help keep it warm, and also that torpedo shape. On the next slide, you'll see some more emperors. This past season, there was all the ice in front of McMurdo Station broke up and washed out, and so we had open water and a chance for lots and lots of penguins to be present. One of the things Mrs. Babb told me that you would be studying this year is what happens when scientists start looking at all of these organisms that Dr. Marsh has been talking about sort of in one picture. And if you go to the next slide, scientists call this a food web. A food web is a way to follow the energy through an ecosystem. It's a way to think about which organisms eat which ones. And I know you can't read all of these, but what I wanted you to see was that food webs generally use pictures of organisms and arrows to show the flow of energy. So, for example, if a penguin eats a fish, there will be an arrow that connects the fish to the penguin. And then if the penguin gets eaten by a seal, there's an arrow that connects the penguin to the seal, because that's the way the energy flows from one organism to another. Remember, the food that we eat contains energy that we need, and that's true for organisms, even in an extreme place like Antarctica, just like it's true for you guys who just had lunch. And so, at this point in time, Mrs. Babb, we'd like to open it up to student questions. So we've talked a lot, and we appreciate everyone's attention, but we're sure that you probably have some questions for Dr. Marsh and I. So all you need to do is come over to the computer, push the talk button, and ask your question loudly and clearly, and we'll try to answer it.
Hi, I'm Eve Cross, and this is my question. Have you had an emergency where you need something?
So, lucky for us, there haven't been any major emergencies, although that's a great question. And we do spend a lot of time when we first get here discussing safety. And what happens here at McMurdo Station when there is an emergency. In fact, the fire department here has done a drill the last 2 days where they practice what would happen if somebody were to be seriously injured and we had to respond, or if there was a fire or a fuel spill. As far as divers, we do the same types of safety practices. We think about what would happen if a piece of equipment failed or if a diver were seriously injured, how we would handle that. And so we spend a lot of time sort of thinking about ways to be safe and avoid those situations. Dr. Marsh and I would say that the biggest emergency so far has been when we come back up and we're really cold and we need to warm up quickly. We're always looking for where the stove is in the dive hut or if somebody has made us a cup of hot chocolate because we need to warm up fast. But a great question.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Estes, and my question is if you see a lot of penguins almost every day, and what types do you see, and if they're local at the campsite?
So, great question, Elizabeth. Of the two penguins that we showed you, we've only seen one so far this year. It's kind of early in the season. Remember, we're just coming out of the Antarctic winter and rapidly transitioning to its summertime. A little bit later, usually beginning of November into December and January, is when the station will see a lot of penguins. So far it's just been two. They've both been emperor penguins, the one on the left in this slide. But we're hoping that before we leave, we get a chance to see a few more. So great question, but just two so far.
Hi, I'm Grace Sanders, and my question is, how do you think this expedition in Antarctica will change you?
So Dr. Marsh has had a lot of experience in Antarctica, and I think he could talk about how it's really changed his life. But this is only my second time here, and as a teacher, like your teacher, Mrs. Babb, my experience here has made me a much better scientist. I know what it's like to work in the field and to do science in sometimes difficult situations, the importance of collecting good data and making observations. And so I'm going to bring all of that back to my students back in the classroom. on top of all that, I've met an incredible number of really, really neat people. There are about 500 people here on station. Each of them has an amazing amount of worldly experience. They're well-traveled. They read a lot, and they're just interesting people to meet and talk with. So I've made a lot of new friends. I've learned a lot of new skills and information, and I'm going to bring all that back with me. I think that sort of answers your question. So thanks for a great one.
Hi, my name is Dylan McKernan, and my question is, does the hole ever close up?
The hole.
Oh, close.
The dive hole.
Yeah, that is a good question. It is cold enough, and that's why we have to drag the huts over the holes themselves to slow the rate at which they freeze. The hole will not freeze fast enough while we're under the water, so it never closes. But over about a two-week period during this time of year, a hole like this will get to be about half the size that you see here. And so there is a limited period that we can dive, use a hole for diving.
Hi, my name is Morgan Casabri, and my question is, how do you get the fuel for your vehicle?
Can you repeat that one more time? I know it was about the vehicles, but we weren't sure exactly what you asked.
She wanted to know how you get the fuel for the vehicles.
Yeah, great question, and a really important one when we're talking about energy. All the fuel has to be brought here to McMurdo Station. That's every drop. We don't drill any in Antarctica. We don't pump it up from the ground like we do in other places. So once a year, there is a very large container ship that pulls into McMurdo. Immediately before that, an icebreaker ship comes in to break up the ice and allow that container ship to get in. And then millions of gallons are pumped out of the ship and into large holding containers. So every drop of fuel is very precious. And everyone here is constantly reminded to conserve fuel and be careful in your energy use and to make sure that you don't waste anything or have any drips or spills out in the environment. So you are 100% correct that fuel is a major, major concern and something that we are constantly being reminded of. But, yeah, it's all shipped down here or flown in by airplane, and that's how we get our fuel.
Hi, my name is Andy Doster, and what kind of wildlife have you seen?
So the photos that Dr. Marsh showed you have really covered a lot of the interesting organisms that we've seen. I would say the list looks something like sea stars, sea urchins, sea spiders like the one that you see here, lots and lots of anemones and sponges, jellyfish like this one. We have seen a large number of seals this year, more than I remember from my previous year. And in fact, we were doing a dive yesterday, and the seals were making these incredible noises underwater. They were so loud that I was constantly kind of looking around to see if the seals were really close behind me. But just some amazing, amazing organisms that we get a chance to see on every dive. And I think every dive is a really special experience and a great way to see the organisms under the ice.
My name is Jack Emgren, and my question is, why are you so interested in the worm?
So the worm, the capitella of the worm, actually has a very close species related to it that lives just off the coast of New Jersey and Delaware. Right? So in my lab back at the University of Delaware, I work with that species, that local species. So we have a species from New Jersey, Delaware, and then we have a very closely related species down here in Antarctica. And so by comparing those two species, we can actually get a handle on what it is about temperature living at polar temperatures, harsh polar environment, has shaped the way the genome, the genes of this capitella worm, are structured and the way that they are expressed. So simply because that comparative nature to go from a warm environment to a cold environment. It's also, as I mentioned earlier, a worm that's often associated with pollution and human impacts on environments. And so we can kind of begin to compare how human impacts in an environment, in a polar environment, may or may not be different than human impacts in an environment, like, say, off New Jersey or Delaware. So it's just a good comparison system for us to work with. And that was a very good question. Thank you.
I'm Julia Young, and I want to know how hard it is to swim with all the scuba gear on.
Hi, Julia. Great question. Yeah, it's not the easiest thing to go swimming with all of that gear on. Think about wearing your biggest, thickest snowsuit, like what you would wear on the very coldest day in New Jersey to go outside. And think about the gloves that you wear and the hat that you wear. And then think about adding some extra weight on top of that. And instead of having boots on, you have these big goofy flippers. And that's pretty much the experience of wearing all this gear. It's big, it's heavy, and you're constantly thinking about how your body is moving and where the air is located in the suit. But all that being said, it's really worth the experience of getting to see what's on, what organisms are underneath the ice. And Dr. Marsh has a lot more experience than I do, so he has something else to offer.
Yeah, just one other quick comment is that indeed it is hard to swim, but because we're going from a single ice hole, that is, we enter the hole and we have to exit out through that hole, right? You don't want to swim very far, and we're not going to be swimming far. So we do work. When we're in the water, we're not working far, swimming far. We're just doing a lot of work right within about 100 feet of that circle anyway. And so we tend to wear a lot of stuff more for keeping warm, keeping the bulk up, having lots of insulation layers, and less for worrying about the aerodynamics of swimming. Because you're actually more like a blimp kind of floating around in the water once you've got all that stuff on. And Mike's example, I'd say once you get, so the best way to think of it is that once you got dressed with all your heavy winter gear to get it to go outside, imagine then putting on a couple layers of garbage bags over that just to fill it out. And that's how awkward it is once you are dressed up. Thanks. That's definitely a good question.
This is Amy Bittencourt, and my question is, when are you going down the hole, why can't you hit the side?
That's a great question, and sometimes we do. When I was here in 2005, the hole that you're looking at was much thicker because the ice was much thicker. It was like being inside of a tunnel. So the reason we drill such large holes is so that we can fit the diver and our tank through that hole without really scraping up against the sides too much. It can happen, and it's okay to touch the ice, but it definitely is something that we try to avoid, just so we don't scrape our gear against the ice. Great question.
Hi, my name is Catherine Byers. My question is, how do you get fresh water to drink?
So on station, we have a fresh water plant, and the fresh water is made from seawater. It's made by a process called reverse osmosis. And so what they do is they take seawater in and literally push the fresh water out of the seawater, leaving all the salts behind. And so all the water on station is made, and we are constantly being reminded about how to conserve fresh water on station. Right? Because it does take a lot of energy to make the fresh water that we all drink here. We do drink a lot of fresh water, and there's no restrictions on how much water you drink because, again, it's a polar desert is the environment that we're in, and so you lose a lot of water during the day. So you constantly need to be drinking about 2 liters of water a day. But for other activities like doing laundry, showering, if you're going to wash cars or doing anything with fresh water, we do have to conserve and keep a very mindful eye on usage. Very good question. Thanks.
They were just.
You guys have more questions?
I think they might have been just dry.
Yeah. We can't hear you, Lynette. Yeah, we aren't hearing you. So I'm not sure what happened to your microphone there. Yeah, I don't know. Did you hit a mute button or something by accident? Or not sure what's going on with the sound on your end.
Sorry, we stepped on the, one of the cords and disconnected it.
Aha, uh-huh, that would do it. Okay.
One of my students just asked, if you were diving and you're under the water, what would happen if the dive hole froze over?
So a great question. On a lot of our dive sites, we actually drill a second hole that acts as a safety hole. But just like Dr. Marsh spoke about a little earlier, the freezing process usually takes several hours to days. So it's not really likely that while we're under the ice, the hole would freeze over. Also, before we jump in, we make sure to sort of chip all the newly formed ice out of the hole. Dr. Marsh was sort of alluding to yesterday a dive that we made in an unheated hut. And before we jumped in, we had to chip a fair bit of ice out of the hole, clear it all out, and then we jumped in. But even in an unheated hut, it was still perfectly fine for the entire dive. You have to remember, we get cold pretty quickly, so a typical dive isn't more than 45 minutes underwater.
My name is Sal Artizone, and what is the best experience you ever saw when you were down there?
That's a great question and a really tough one to pick absolutely one. So I'll name a couple. Underneath the ice, I've had some really amazing experiences. On one dive, I found an octopus that sort of was able to pick up and hold, and it sort of swam. On this year, we've seen a tremendous number of seals that have come very close to us and sort of been interacting with the divers a little bit, which has been absolutely tremendous. And then also the scenery. It's really hard to show you in pictures, but you can see amazing distances underwater, and it makes you feel like you're swimming in sort of like the Grand Canyon or a place that has tremendous landscape scenery, all amazingly beautiful. And each moment is really a special experience under the ice. I don't know if Dr. Marsh wants to share one of his favorite moments, maybe.
Well, I'll just add that just swimming under the ice is such an alien environment that almost every dive is a pretty spectacular dive. I mean, you're just seeing things that very few people get to see, and it's a perspective on life in a frozen wasteland that very few understand. And so I'm constantly amazed by, I constantly see things that strike me as being very mysteries, that it would take a lot of research to understand what's going on in that particular observation. I mean, there's just a lot of organisms, very interesting with currents, lights, primary productivity. It's a very unique environment. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Becca Zanovich, and my question is, how long do you spend underwater each dive?
So generally, you're underwater for as long as you can stand it, and that's about anywhere from 35 to about 45 minutes. We have at least the air capacity to stay down longer, but by 45 minutes, your body core is really beginning to feel chilled, beginning to shiver, and so it's definitely time to get out of the water at that point.
Hi, my name is Brooke Inferna. My question is, what type of sharks live in Antarctica?
Oh, sharks.
It's actually a great question with a pretty uninteresting answer. There are no sharks in Antarctica where we are. And so they're just not adapted to living here, and none that scientists have found.
Hi, my name is Peyton. My question is, when you guys go under the ice, is it dangerous?
Wow, Peyton, great question. It can be, but at the same time, we take a lot of safety precautions to make sure that every diver who enters the water can safely return. Remember, there's only one way into the under the ice world, only one dive hole that we've made, and only one way back. And so if something goes wrong, you always have to know where that dive hole is and how to get there safely. We also dive with redundant equipment, which means if one of our regulators fails, we have the opportunity to replace it with one that we have on our body right then and there. We always dive with buddies. So when we're on scuba diving, it's always at least two divers. And we always are looking out for each other. So even when we're working, we're watching where our buddy is and making sure that they're being safe. And if they have any problems, that we can help them. And they're also watching out for us. And there have been several times this year where Adam or I have needed something, and we have turned to each other and said, hey, could you help me with this? And so there's a lot of that sort of underwater communication with our hands. So the answer to your question is yes, this could be dangerous, but we do a lot of things to make sure that we stay safe. So great question, Peyton.
My name is Michael Murphy, and I was wondering, have you found the worms and how they adapt to the cold water?
So, yeah, we've definitely found Capitella. We've got probably 1,000 of them in culture right now that we're beginning some temperature experiments with. We have a lot of work still to do to understand patterns of adaptation in them. So give me a call next year. All right? But we are working towards that end. Yes. Thanks.
One thing that your question points out is that this is just part of Dr. Marsh's project. We are collecting the worms, and we are studying them a little bit in the lab here. But then he'll take them back to Delaware, and this work will continue. And I think that's one thing that we all forget, is that we see scientists in the field, and that's only a small part of what they actually spend their time doing. A lot of it is back at their lab, analyzing data and looking for patterns in what they've collected out in the field. So great question, and as Dr. Marsh said, there's still a lot of work to be done to get to that answer of how are these worms adapted.
Hi, I'm Henry Flynn. Can you name some of the most interesting animal species that you've seen?
Well, it's tough to pick just one that would be the most interesting. I would say one of my favorites, looking around at the bottom, has been the sea urchin. And I think a lot of people forget how interesting the sea urchin's adaptations are. It has these spines on the outside, and the slide that you're looking at, those small purple sort of spiky objects on the right and the left are sea urchins. And sea urchins have a couple of interesting adaptations, which is why I think they're so neat. They have thousands of tube feet, which are what help them sort of move around. They have those spikes, which are a deterrent to other organisms who may want to try to eat them. And then, as you can see in the sea urchin on the right, they also sort of collect parts of the environment to try to camouflage themselves. This sea urchin is wearing a bit of sort of a leafy seaweed to try to blend in with the bottom, and we see urchins doing that a lot. So I think if I had to pick just one that had sort of an interesting story, my choice would be the sea urchin. And I think Dr. Marsh has a different one, so let's hear from him.
Yeah, just a couple dives ago, Mike and I saw a sea slug, a very large sea slug. Now, you know what a slug is. It's a big snail, doesn't have a shell. But this one, the ones in the marine environment are called nudibranchs. And the one we saw was so big, like a bunny rabbit, right? Remember the bunny rabbit? Yeah, nudibranch. So, and it had these two white, big, fat tentacles coming off its head that actually looked like bunny ears. And so it's pretty amazing, you know, to be on the dive and you see these kind of really interesting organisms. You don't see them very frequently, but when you do, it's like, wow, that is really interesting. Thanks.
And if you can't hear the excitement in Dr. Marsh's voice, that's somebody who has been diving in Antarctica on 15 different trips. So you can see that even after all that experience, it's still very easy to get excited about what we see underneath the ice.
Hi, my name is Rachel. My question is it hard keeping warm?
Sorry, we missed that last part. Is it hard?
She wants to know if it's hard to keep warm.
It's a constant challenge to keep warm, not only under the ice, but also just walking around town. I think Dr. Marsh and I have both noticed that we wear a lot of more clothing than we do in Delaware or you guys do in New Jersey. That's one big difference. Another big difference is we eat a lot of food. We are constantly eating tons and tons of food that our body then transforms into heat. I remember the night of my first dive here from this season, when I went to bed that night and pulled the blankets on, my body felt tremendously warm because my body had suddenly realized that it needed to take all those calories that I was eating and change it into heat energy to keep me warm. So here's an example of a plate. I'll usually eat three plates like this every day, which is very unusual for me. I have breakfast, lunch, and dinner here. I rarely miss a meal. I drink lots of fluids. And one of the best parts about staying warm is you can eat a lot of dessert and you don't gain any weight. I call it the Antarctic diet. So I'll usually eat two or three desserts at dinner. And it's a great, great sort of little treat to help keep your body warm and fuel it with all that sugar and calories.
I'm Delaney, and my question is, what is your favorite marine animal?
We didn't catch that. Can you repeat it, please?
What's your favorite marine animal?
Did you get that, Mike? What's your favorite marine animal?
We are. We're having a little discussion as if we can only pick one, which one would we pick? I think we'd have to say for right now, our favorite marine animal is Capitella because that's what we're focused on. If I had to pick one from down here, I think I'm probably going to go with the emperor penguin. It's just an amazing bird. Emperor penguins are tremendously different from other penguins. They're huge by comparison, over 3 feet tall. They're sort of majestic. They're beautiful coloring. And just amazing, amazing organisms.
Hi, my name is Stephanie, and my question is, what did you use for shelter?
So actually, we do have a slide in here that shows you Adam in my room, and it sort of looks like your typical bedroom. We live in heated buildings, and we have bunk beds with closets. And it's kind of your standard. If you have any older brothers and sisters who are in college, it sort of looks like a room that you might have if you stayed at college or maybe if you went to a sleepover camp. And then the buildings are nice and heated. There's a bathroom at the end of the hallway. And so that's sort of what we live in. We do have the opportunity to spend time out on the ice, usually just one night. And for that, we stay in tents. And again, it's not something you do a lot of, but it is something that sometimes has to happen.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and my question is, how much longer are you staying in Antarctica?
Yeah, good question, because I'm coming back October 10th, so I'm already counting down the days. But Mike's going to be here a little bit longer, so he still has a little bit more diving to do.
Hi, my name is Rachel, and I want to know how you get your spot.
How you what?
She wants to know how you get your supplies.
So as somebody asked about the fuel, all of our supplies are either flown in or brought in by ship. And so every single piece of equipment that's brought down from the big trucks and tractors, even to the smallest piece of food, has to be flown or shipped here. And so we're always reminded to treat the equipment and the materials that we receive very carefully because it's an expensive process to replace them. And also all the trash that's produced has to be handled very carefully and shipped back to the United States as well. So great question.
Last question. I'm Melissa Allen. Have you seen any mammals? What kind?
Sorry, was that mammals or animals?
Mammals.
So the major mammal that we see is the Weddell seal. We've shown you a few pictures of them, and the Weddell seal is a really interesting organism, and it's been a special treat this year to see so many of them in the water and hear them in the water and see them around the sea ice cracks. That's very different than what I experienced on my first trip here. So great question.
Did you guys just say that was the last question, or did you have some more?
Well, I think that a lot of the questions you've answered through your other dialogue. So is there anything else you'd like to share with us? We'd appreciate that.
I'd just like to say thank you to Mrs. Babb for putting this together and for working with us. She worked really hard to make this happen for all of you students. So thank her very much, and also thank you to the Polar Truck folks, and just want to say that it's been a great experience talking to you this afternoon. You guys have asked some amazing questions. It's been a real special treat for us as the research team to get a chance to talk with you, so thank you for your attention and working with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a great experience. All the children were so excited about it, and you've shared so much with us. We really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure sharing your classroom with us. Thanks a lot, Lynette.
Bye.
Bye from Antarctica.
All right. Thank you all. And we'll send out the link, everybody, so you have it to share. And thanks. Have a good afternoon and a good morning in Antarctica.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Archive recording has been stopped. Archive is